From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil was suspended from office after the Senate voted in favor of impeaching her and putting her on trial following a 20-hour debate in Brasilia Thursday. The twice-elected president will be tried over allegations that her budget overstated revenues in order to allow the continued funding of essential food aid and other anti-poverty programs. That trial could lead to her removal from office. The Senate marathon session lasted for almost 21 hours and was met with large protests in support of her and against what many call an illegal coup. Rousseff herself maintains that she's committed no crime and that this latest in a series of attempts to oust her was political. Last week, in a televised interview with Telesur's Ernesto Villegas, the twice-elected Workers' Party president described the history of the attempts by the right wing to remove her since her re-election.
From the beginning of my second term, the opposition was very unhappy with the outcome of the result. And they then attempted to grab power not through elections. First, what they did, they requested the recounting of votes, and this was done, and this confirmed that they had won the elections. Then they requested an audit of the ballot boxes. They demanded that the ballot boxes were checked, and this demonstrated that there was no rigging in the process, and there was a clean process. Then they tried to appeal to the Supreme Electoral Tribunal to prevent me to take oath, the oath of office. And again, this failed. The results were confirmed. However, they were still unsatisfied, and they, in December last, the current speaker of the lower house, which is currently under investigation for offshore accounts and other accusations, for instance, of money laundering, and different investigations on the activities in the mismanagement. So he was brought before the Ethics Commissions. And in order not to be condemned by this commission, he required three votes. And the government had the three votes. So he said that if the government did not vote in his favor, he would initiate the process of impeachment, and that's what he did. It was widely covered by the media. So the vice president, belonging to the same party of the speaker of the house, they were in cahoots, and then they are trying to control the process of impeachment and attain the presidency, not through votes. They are trying to use the impeachment, which is, in truth, a way to attain power through indirect elections, because they lack the votes and they do not have a platform that would be approved by the Brazilian people. So the truth of the matter is that the political alliance that you had for years with the party of the vice president was dissolved due to this betrayal of the vice president. And today, he's forming new government, announcing a new platform, and he's ready to take up the reins of power.
The other countries of South America and the Caribbean are standing behind the embattled president. Among them, the Secretary General of the Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR, Ernesto Samper, who told Telesur that Dilma Rousseff remained, quote, the legitimate leader, closed quote, of the Brazilian nation. He said she maintains democratic legitimacy by virtue of having been reelected in 2014. During a press conference Thursday, the Secretary General of UNASUR said that the decision of the Brazilian Congress to initiate the impeachment trial against her was, quote, compromising the democratic governability of the region in a dangerous way, closed quote. President Rousseff called on Brazilians to move into the streets and not allow a right-wing coup to capture the government. We will continue to cover these events as they develop. A proposal by Russia to blacklist two terrorist groups operating in Syria has been blocked by the U.S. at the United Nations Security Council. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
The U.S., Britain, France, and Ukraine opposed Russia's bid to blacklist Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham militant groups for links to Daesh and al-Qaeda terrorists. The U.S. mission to the U.N. had signaled it would block the move, saying it would undermine attempts to get a sustained halt in the fighting in Syria. Jaish al-Islam is part of Riyadh-based Syria opposition group, the High Negotiations Committee. Ahrar al-Sham also took part in the latest round of Syria peace talks. However, Russia has always voiced its objection to including the two groups in peace negotiations.
A U.S. missile defense system in Europe was set to become operational Thursday at an air base in southern Romania. The so-called SM-2 missile interceptor is stationed in Devisalu and is reportedly set to be integrated into NATO missile shields in July. Moscow protested the move, calling it a threat aimed at Russia, directly contradicting promises made by the U.S. when the Bush administration unilaterally withdrew from the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002. At that time, the U.S. claimed that withdrawal from the treaty was necessary to protect itself from attack and/or nuclear blackmail by rogue states. This was then President George W. Bush announcing the U.S. withdrawal in December of 2001.
Today, I have given formal notice to Russia, in accordance with the treaty, that the United States of America is withdrawing from this almost 30-year-old treaty. I have concluded the ABM treaty hinders our government's ability to develop ways to protect our people from future terrorists or rogue state missile attacks. The 1972 ABM treaty was signed by the United States and the Soviet Union at a much different time in a vastly different world. One of the signatories, the Soviet Union, no longer exists. And neither does the hostility that once led both our countries to keep thousands of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert pointed at each other. Thank you.
For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University on geopolitics, via Skype Thursday. So, Mark, the U.S. is moving more material up near Russia, this time a new anti-missile defense system that's lighting up today, apparently.
Yes, actually, this is part of the Aegis Ashore program. It's actually run by the U.S. Navy. It is a new kind of a piecemeal ballistic missile defense shield. This is part of it. The portion in Romania, which consists of a powerful radar shield, which will, besides providing the radar for a ballistic missile shield, will also provide a minute radar coverage of Russia up to the Urals. Okay, so absolute complete observation of what's happening in Russia up to the Urals. Also, another portion of this Aegis Ashore program in Poland, work has begun on it now, and that is expected to be completed in 2018. This system will allow for the interception of a small number of intercontinental ballistic missiles, specifically able to target intermediate range ones. Why Russia is so concerned about this is, first of all, for its potential for first strike capability. Maybe not in isolation, this portion or this system in itself, but we see this as part of a global overlapping a ring of containment that is going up around Russia and China. The U.S. already has its own systems. There are some more primitive systems in Europe already. This is going up in Poland and Romania. The U.S., Secretary of Defense Carter is now insistent that this THAAD system will go into place in South Korea, which threatens China's strategic deterrent as well as Russia. And all of this is being undone under the pretext that it is against Iran in the European theater and against North Korea in the Eastern theater, in the Asia Pacific. Now, of course, this is just a pretext. Iran doesn't have any nuclear weapons whatsoever. There is a new deal completed with the United States, with UN agencies overseeing it, to ensure that they do not develop a nuclear weapons program. North Korea's ballistic missile tests all recently have completely failed. They all fly in the face of the entirely massive U.S. strategic deterrent, which would make anyone firing one or two missiles immediately vulnerable to complete annihilation and suicide. This system doesn't threaten Russia's nuclear deterrent, but in the same way that the United States argues that it needs it for future developments, not that Iran has a nuclear weapon now. This is Russia's concern as well, that this system will be slowly built upon, expanded, piecemeal, pieces here, pieces there, improvements there, and this will continue unabated over time. They see it as precedent setting, and that this presents a marginal strategic threat at this point, but a much greater threat going on into the future as new developments and new parts, new systems come in place.
And now, some more coverage of the 2016 U.S. presidential election. In her weekly column at blackagendareport.com, Margaret Kimberly, who pens the column Freedom Rider, calls on Sanders supporters to reject Hillary Clinton if she becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party. We spoke with her via Skype Thursday. Margaret, welcome back.
Hi, Don. Thank you.
So this week's Freedom Rider column at blackagendareport.com, Sanders supporters can bring down the Democratic Party. Let's talk about that.
Yes. As the campaign season winds down, and Sanders does continue to win primaries, but Hillary Clinton has an advantage in superdelegates. So it appears that it is more likely she will get the nomination than Sanders. And Sanders supporters are in a quandary about what to do should she become the nominee. Sanders has said all along he would endorse her. If he didn't win the nomination, he would endorse the nominee. But his supporters are in a quandary, having gone all out, having been so excited for this possibility of change, away from the corporatist and imperialistic Democratic Party. They don't want to endorse Hillary. They don't want her. They don't want to endorse her. And they should not. My argument is there are a variety of things that one can do, not vote for the presidential line, write someone in, vote for another party, and not to be afraid of Trump victory, not to be afraid of being called a spoiler, because whether they realize it or not, what needs to happen is that the Democratic Party needs to be done once and for all. There is no reforming it. There's no fixing it. They don't want to change. They are exactly who they are. They do not have our interests in mind, the interests of working people, the interests of those of us who want a nation that is not imperialist, the interest of those of us who want an end to mass incarceration, to bailing out of the wealthiest 1%. In order to do any of those things, we have to get rid of the Democrats.
You know, if the Sanders people were looking at recent history, going back to 2000, for example, to the 2000 election, Ralph Nader was blamed for the loss by Al Gore to George Bush in 2000.
Right.
You know, he made the case, and credibly, that his candidacy had little or nothing to do with the loss, that there were other factors that were identified. But to me, his failure was, instead of doing that, failing to say, you know what, we own it, we did it, and we're going to do it again unless you guys change your tune or unless things change. And then we had 2004, essentially a replay with John Kerry sitting on voter theft in Ohio and elsewhere.
Yep.
And then we get a Democratic president who continues essentially the policies of Bush, except where he amplified them. So that strategy of sitting down and taking whatever happens and getting behind the Democratic candidate clearly doesn't work.
No, but you know, it depends on what it is that people actually want.
Right.
A lot of Sanders people, there's just this hope for a better Democrat. And people don't go as far as I said to say, this party needs to go and we need to start something new. We need to vote for a different party. Many people mention the Greens, or we need to start something new. People don't really want that to happen. Some of them are afraid. Some of them don't believe it. The propaganda is so intense about being so afraid of Republicans, though you look at history, Democrats end up enacting what Republicans speak about openly.
Right.
Anyway, it's Clinton who got rid of welfare as an entitlement. It's Clinton who expanded NATO to Russia's border and has created this crisis and a new Cold War. So it's Clinton who legitimized mass incarceration. So we should not be so afraid of Republicans and so enamored of Democrats. So that's the other thing that needs to be pointed out time and again. And I think if we talk about those facts, they're just simple facts that are easily proven, and start to work on this paranoia. Well, I wouldn't call it paranoia. It's not the right word. But this fear of Republicans, which is disproportionate when you think about what Democrats actually do when they get into office.
You know, and looking to Clinton in particular as a standard bearer for, you know, to stand up against that is ahistorical as all hell, because if you look back to the Clinton administration, as you pointed out, you have the end of welfare as an entitlement. You have the Telecommunications Act, which created mm-hmm. the present communications environment where Fox and, you know, all of those are dominant in the ongoing political and social narrative here. You have the expansion of NATO to the borders of Russia. You have the renunciation of any attempt to really build an alliance or decent relations with Russia. You
right.
have the turnaround under Hillary Clinton of policy towards China, so that we're now actively hostile towards China as well. I don't know exactly what she's going to do to stop a Republican agenda, which actually, from Trump on foreign policy, sounds less aggressive than Clinton has actually been.
Oh, absolutely, much less so. He, you know, doesn't speak of these things in the way I do, but I would like it if someone said we don't have any need for NATO at all, but he says European countries should pay more of their fair share, and why are we the world's policemen, and why do we do regime change? It's created these disastrous situations. He's so unpredictable, and the rest of his policies are things I can't go along with. And you never know where Trump is going to come down. But he is to the left of her on certain issues. That's absolutely true. So we are stuck with, and people see it now. I think that's why Sanders has been more popular than expected. I think more than Sanders expected, actually. There are those who argue that he was never running to win the nomination, that he didn't take her on the subject of the emails, for example, that she had classified information on her private email account, which is against the law, that he could use that against her, and that at certain points he does hold back. So I think people see it now. It's just become too much and too obvious, and that is the explanation for Sanders' popularity. The problem is, even though people see that, they don't know that they have choices. The way our system works in relegating third parties to being possible spoiler status is that it just keeps people in line. And there are people who don't like Hillary Clinton, don't like what she stands for, don't like her husband's policies, and would end up voting for her anyway because of Trump. And but that's something that we have to shake off, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the column. People need to say, not this time. You're not going to scare me. You're not going to use, in this case, Trump as the boogeyman. Let's look at the facts of what Democrats do and don't do, and let's get rid of them altogether. This is the moment to do it.
And then, of course, there's the fear factor, as you mentioned, dealing just with Republicans in general. And if you analyze what the Republicans have become, let's say either beginning in 1964, 1965, with the signing by LBJ of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, et cetera, Nixon's Southern strategy and the movement of white working class Democrats into the Republican Party, and then again with Reagan, you saw this building of a coalition that was led largely by the so-called Christian right ideologically. That has been reconfigured in the Republican Party. They are not dominant anymore. There are still the white supremacists, and Trump throws a nod at them, but it seems that there's almost a class character to the organizing principles around the constituency behind Trump over the trade issues and over the economy, which is the same phenomenon we see happening inside the Democratic Party. Is it possible that that portion behind Sanders that is voting for him on issues, on those issues, is going to see some affinity with Trump and with the breakup of the Republican coalition that formerly existed feel a little more comfort?
I don't know if they necessarily feel an affinity, but I think they'll be less afraid. They should be less afraid of a Trump presidency. And hopefully that will prevent people, these millions of voters who voted for Sanders, it will prevent them from thinking they have to vote for Hillary. You know, Trump is problematic. It's, you know, the Republican Party, as you said, became the white people's party over time. And his appeal is mostly about white nationalism, building a wall, keeping out immigrants, Latino immigrants, keeping out Muslims. That is a very blatant appeal to white people, and who many of whom voted for Republicans, but clearly didn't care about trade deals, or which have hurt them, hurt their prospects in life. Who don't care about foreign policy, who don't care about, you know, hedge fund managers who, you know, who propped up, you know, the likes of Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. They don't care about these things. They care about bread and butter issues. And Trump does legitimately speak to a very important issue, the fact that neoliberalism has, you know, people call it the American dream or the middle class dream. It has destroyed the economy and destroyed the prospects of working people to earn a living wage. And that does, that is a legitimate point to make. And it's the Democrats and Republicans are in cahoots on these issues. They all do the same thing. And I think I can't dismiss everything that Trump says, but I find it interesting that no Democrat, the party that's supposed to be so progressive and that's supposed to stand up for working people, there's no Democratic candidate who says this. No establishment, that is to say, one with a lot of money behind them that will say those things.
You know, and looking at, you know, after January 20th of next year, if Trump were to be elected, or Sanders for that matter, neither of them have been positing alternative candidates in primaries for Congress. And so you're going to have a Congress that is in favor of these trade deals. And if either of them is president, but we'll go to Trump in terms of the fear of Democrats of Trump, you could be looking at a situation next year where Trump is looking to kill, say, the TPP and TTIP, and Congress is overwhelmingly organizing to override a veto. You'd have Trump's voters in the streets over that, or a good chunk of them. Could we see a coalition building between or among Trump and Sanders supporters over those issues, attempting to prop Trump up against the Congress next year?
It's hard to say. I think people can, it could be sort of a de facto coalition, the fact that that's an issue that they can't agree on and that they all want to oppose. But I think there's some basic things that would keep any real coalition building between Sanders and Trump people. Like the racism of many Trump supporters is problematic, and rightly so. It should not be ignored.
Right.
And so I think many people on the left will find it hard to find common cause, even when there's agreement on an issue. But, you know, it could in fact be a successful effort to make good on that, what is a good campaign pledge. So that's possible.
And then looking at the contraposition, you have people that are lining up behind Clinton on exactly that issue. In fact, that think because they believe, despite the polls, she would be a stronger candidate against Trump, that the way to defend against the racism that is at least latent in Trump's campaign would be to back Clinton, despite the fact that she took her husband and she, but her husband's presidency, took the Democratic Party back to a position where it would appeal to the same white supremacists who had left the Democratic Party in the wake of Lyndon Johnson. And, you know, policy-wise, despite the, you know, wall-to-wall picture of CBC and black ministers, et cetera, that stand behind a Clinton whenever they're on television, these policies are there for on the record.
Yes, they are. And people have, you know, I think the spell has been broken and people are willing to talk about it at last, thank God, almost 20 years after Clinton left office. But it's very important that this is now said out loud. I think it's just at a certain point it becomes too much. And Hillary Clinton, she's not gifted, frankly. She may be an intelligent person, but she's not as smooth as Obama, who can get people to buy into things that they don't like. She's just way too obvious. She gets Gaddafi killed and then laughs about it. Obama's smart enough not to do things like that. So her ham-fistedness and her constant lying, I think... she's not as good a politician as her husband or Obama. So now it's all out in the open. It's obvious. And even those black voters who, because they're so afraid of a Republican victory and gravitated towards her because she appeared to be the most successful candidate, you know, the turnout is lower. The number of votes she's received is much lower. So I don't think we'll see that kind of excitement. Now, the people you mentioned, the, you know, well-connected clergy and the politicians, they all have endorsed her. But I don't believe the rank and file are excited. And those people are just cynics. They do that because that keeps their gravy train running. But I don't see that really true excitement about the prospect of her being president.
And finally, looking forward, you know, you close the article with saying it's time for Sanders supporters to make good on their calls for revolution by actively and openly denying Hillary Clinton the presidency. I'm wondering if they make that call in advance of Philadelphia, is it possible that they could impact somehow the outcome of the Democratic National Convention?
Possibly. I think people right now, things are still in flux about anyone having, you know, the number of delegates needed to win. And I think they are hopeful. I think they should not be, but they're still hopeful that Sanders may speak up or not endorse her or make demands. But I think that rings pretty hollow. It would be more dramatic, I suppose, politically to wait until the convention. But I think if there was a groundswell now, that could possibly impact things. But the bigger problem actually is where people, Sanders supporters, truly stand. Was revolution just a marketing word? And I believe it was. I don't think they're ready for revolution. They're not ready to ditch the Democrats, most of them. And that is why I and others are saying this now in an effort to influence them to speak up for true change and to know that they should not be afraid. They cannot be afraid. We just get more of the same when we get Democratic presidents. And it's not clear to me how much we would get with a Bernie Sanders' presidency, but that's another story.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.